John, good morning. This was
morning, Steve.
This was sad. I feel terrible
for
Rhonda.
It was an absolute shock. Yesterday morning, Bill Hirsch called me and asked me if I wanted to go out to an event with he and Mary because Bob and Wanda couldn't make it. They were scheduled to go out last night. And he said Bob had gotten ill on Sunday. He went to a brunch at Indian Creek Country Club where he he and Wanda spent a lot of time. And apparently he got stomach upset or whatever that evening and didn't sleep all night, had, you know, was very sick. And I'm not sure whether he passed away on the way to the hospital in the ambulance or at the hospital, but it was a shock. I had dinner with him last week, and everybody's saying the same thing. Gee, I saw him yesterday, you know, that type of thing. I read Rich Orbed's comment that he was beloved, and that's the perfect word. He was such a sweet guy. He was a true racetracker, you know, having come up as a kid, worked on the starting gate at Atlantic City and so forth. And like you said, he worked his way up. He was the general manager of Atlantic City and the Meadowlands and after that Garden State Park and Retama Park, and involved in so many racetracks. But I always used to think of him as a true racetracker, because when I would ask, I would quiz him, you know, because I got involved in racetrack management myself, and he was the first guy I went to for advice. And he said, well, I remember one thing he told me, one of the first things he told me, he says, well, I go in the morning, he says, and if I need a haircut, I go into the track barber, which was back when they had barbers at the track, get my hair cut, and then I go walk through all the men's rooms. You know, and he said, that's what you have to do if you want to run a racetrack. You don't sit up in your office or hang out in the clubhouse. You get down and talk to everybody that works for you. You talk to the ushers. You talk to the admissions people. You talk to guys in the parking lot. And that's what Bob Quigley did. And your comment about how many people had worked for him. People that started out, you know, parking cars at the track, worked for Bob Quigley and ended up running racetracks. And he was so beloved because he treated the guys in the parking lot or the admissions people or whatever they did, dishwashers, he would stop and talk to them, you know, just as if they were the you know, president of NYRA. He had time for everybody. And it was just a really, you know, it's hard to say it these days, but he was just an all-around nice guy. He was a hunter and fisherman. And like I say, grew up in the Atlantic City area. And I remember him telling me stories about, he remembered, this is when Boardwalk Empire was a big item on HBO. He was talking about Nucky Thompson. He remembered, he says, yeah, I forget what he told me. He says, Nucky bought a newspaper from him or something one time, and he said he was a big man in town. But he had great words for the Levy family, Bob Levy and his father, Leon Levy, that owned Atlantic City. And Bob knew how to run a racetrack, and he did it, of course, in what we call the heyday of racing in this country. But just a terrific guy, and he will be missed. And it'll be a packed house with whatever they do. They haven't made arrangements yet. I talked to Bill Hirsch this morning. You know, arrangements will be forthcoming. Bob's son and daughter are coming into town today.
There's some things that he was responsible for, I mean, from the 60s into the 70s, and among other things, essentially introduced exotic wagering, exactas and trifectas, if I'm not mistaken, was among the first, you know, at least on the East Coast, one of the first things that he did.
Funny you say that. I mean, I knew Bob. You know, I knew him peripherally when I was a jockey agent back in the early 70s, and I got to know him much better after that. I worked in the mutuals at one point, and when the Meadowlands opened at night, I was doing everything. I was a jockey agent. I was doing everything. But back in my first or second year as a jockey agent, they had started the trifecta at Atlantic City, and that was on the circuit that I was working on. I was doing the you know, you go from Florida up to Garden State in the spring, and then you go to Monmouth, and then you go to Atlantic City, and then you go back to Garden State, and then you go back to Florida, because there was no winter racing back then. And I had a jockey I was handling named Paul Kaly, who's you know, one of the most, everybody should Google Paul Kaly, K-A-L-L-A-I, Hungarian jockey. He only passed away not too long ago. I think he died in the winner's circle after riding a winner at age 72 in Hungary. Paul was a pretty incredible guy. But back in, this is probably about 72 or 3, I really had just started, and he was one of the first jockeys I represented. And the Atlantic City meet was running. And one day they went in, the state troopers came in and arrested all the jockeys. They had been fixing the last race trifecta. This is when the trifecta was in its early days, and they had just been taking out the favorite and you know, and having somebody by the rest of the field, and they'd been doing it regularly. And Bob Quigley, many years later, I brought it up to him, and I said, you know, I was working for this guy the whole time this thing was going on, and I had no idea. I had no idea they were fixing the races. I thought it was great when they'd win one, you know. And he said, oh yeah. He said we had a state trooper following them and watching everything they did, and they just swooped in one day. And I said, well, you could have fooled me with the whole thing, but that was the beginning of the trifecta.
There was nothing that he had not, by the time he reached any kind of a general manager job, and that was in Atlantic City, and you referenced the Nucky Thompson. That, I mean, he was born and raised in AC, right? I mean, he was from Atlantic City.
Yeah, he was an AC guy, yep. So I say, when he was a kid, he said, oh, I remember Nucky, you know, we were talking about Boardwalk Empire. Oh, I remember those guys. He said, I wasn't exactly like that, but he was the guy. He ran the town. I think he told me, he said, I was selling newspapers or something, and he gave me a quarter or something. When, you know, because Bob had to be a little kid, you know. And of course, you know, we talk about him as a thoroughbred guy, but he was, you know, really important in the harness game.
Yes. Yeah.
Had a terrific following of people, and they loved him.
Well, and Sonny Werblin, I mean, literally sought him out to as even before the Meadowlands was built. And one of the things that's pretty fascinating about Quigley is that he literally started as a laborer at Atlantic City, that brick clubhouse. I mean, he was involved in the building of the racetrack. Then he was a stall man.
Worked on the starting gate.
There's nothing. He was the controller at AC. I mean, he literally knew every department, and so, you know, which is the old fashioned. It's he was no 90-day wonder, as they say.
No one trick pony, that's for sure. He will be missed. He had quite a crew down here in Florida that hang with Tommy Trotter, who's another legend in the game. In his 90s, Tommy Roberts, you know, and he was very close with Rich Orban, and I know, and Randy and Ron DeSoth, and of course Billy and Mary Hirsch. That was their crew. But just an all around wonderful guy, and he will be missed. So,
John, how much involvement did you have when Brennan picked him out for the rebuilt Garden State?
I didn't have any involvement. I was running due process, which was Brennan's private stable, and Garden State was International Thoroughbred Breeders. It was a public company,
right?
So there was no crossover between I went to the races. It was just another racetrack to me. I didn't really have anything to, you know, if somebody asked me for my opinion, I gave it, but I wasn't really asked very often. But I think Bob Brennan, you know, being one of the smarter people I ever met, had figured out who were the best. That's what he used to do. He used to try and figure out who was the best at what they did, hire them and let them roll. And that's what he did with Quigley. And he saw what he had done with the Meadowlands. We spent a lot of time with Due Process running horses at the Meadowlands. And, you know, he knew it was going to be a similar type of facility set up, you know, with the top floor dining like a casino. I mean, everybody knew at the time that those tracks were built with that in mind, even though it never came to fruition. And when he hired Bob Quigley, Bob hired Yulee Wyatt as his racing secretary, and some of the other names I mentioned, Rich Orban, and I think Mike Lakow worked for him, Lou Raffetto worked, you know, you could just go on and on. It'll be a full house, that's for sure.
It happens, you mentioned Lou, it's Lou's birthday. So don't forget to send him a...
I talked to him yesterday, and I got ahead of the game, so...
Yeah. One thing that he had is he certainly had a vision of what was happening when it came to the simulcasting market, and he put Meadowlands on the lead on that front too. That one of the reasons that that Meadowlands became what it became for the harness business, especially with Roosevelt. With Roosevelt's demise, the Meadowlands, really captured the essence, the kind of the showplace of harness, and his involvement with that side of the industry. I mean, the Trotting Association, the USDA, and the Harness Tracks of America, and on. He just. One of these people I don't know if the horse players know his name all that well, John, but from an inside racing standpoint, Quigley was really a titan of the last half century.
He definitely was.
I've got a great picture that I'll put up from this, and it's from that night we had dinner at Cafe d'Italia, which is the last time I think. I may have seen there may have been a dinner at Bill and Mary's at their condo that may have come afterward. But that was a really fun night. There were Stanley Huff and his wife and you and me, and I'm trying to remember who else was there. It was a big group.
Yeah,
we had a lot of fun.
I remember, yeah. Howie Kessler was there, I remember. Howie.
I appreciate that. I knew we were absolutely, and I reached out to you last night, knowing that we had to pay appropriate tribute to
The arrangement should be forthcoming tomorrow, I would think, and everybody will be allowed to pay their respects. He'll be here in Florida for the time being.
Well, and Tony, exchanged notes with Tony. He had plenty of occasion, both at Atlantic City and then later when he. Quigley circled back, so I know Tony will say some things too on Thursday. John, a quick update. What are you working on? You must be working on something.
I'm still working on my industry book here, that I've spoken to you about a number of times. It's a 6-month project. It's stretched to over a year now, but we're getting there. It's coming along. When I get closer, I'll talk about it.
All right.
Right now, looking forward to the Irish racing season starting up. Starts in another four or five weeks. The flat season, and there was, of course, the jump season. There's been a few hiccups with the weather over there lately. but we're looking forward. We have our Dublin Racing Club. Our filly is back in training. Give her a couple of months off and let her grow. Kitten on the keys. And looking forward to that. We'll head over there in the spring and have some fun. Maybe you'll come this year.
I'd love to. Is there anything in the offing for a new Dublin Racing Club horse or opportunity for people to get involved in something new?
Well, possibly. I don't know. Right now, I haven't really worked on it. I've got some other things going on, but possibility. We'll think about it. I did like the system that we used last year, where I bought one from the Breeze Up sales, which are different than the U.S. Horses and training sales, in that they're all on turf, and the horses are not quite ready, so they don't squeeze them that much over there. So you can actually hope to buy a horse at a horses and training sale and run it within 2 or 3 weeks, which gets you right into the game. And we were on schedule to do that last year, and of course. She got sick right after we bought her, and we missed a month. But hopefully we'll get back in action again here soon.
Excellent. All right, we'll keep everybody apprised. And we've had some members go over and advantage.
I've had a good time. Yeah, travel. I've set up itineraries for some people. You know, give them advice on. You know, where to go, and it's worked out, and I've got great feedback from some of my members telling me about hotels and restaurants that I didn't know about. But, you know, the big thing about it is getting your passes and getting the farm tours and that type of thing. I think everybody enjoys that. So we're going to try and have some sort of an event towards the fall, maybe before Champions Weekend or something, or one of the weeks before that. You know, get some people together over there. Because a lot of people like to schedule their trips for the end of the season. If you're going, go in September. That's the best time of year there. So.
Very good.
Anyway.
Well, we'll invite people to keep tabs. And as we did when we launched DRC, Dublin. Yeah. RacingClub.com for those that haven't visited, and you get just a taste and stay in contact. And if John adds another horse, you can get involved for either small money or for medium sized money. And,
for
virtually no money.
As Woody Stevens used to say, you know, we win, we go to dinner. We lose, we go to dinner.
I love it. Good job. John, thanks so much.
Okay, take care, Phil. That's Steve. Sorry.
John Ferrata, everybody. And you can follow John on Twitter. And keep up on his adventures, whether he's writing a new book, writing a movie or TV script. Dublin Racing Club. John. No moss growing on John, that's for sure. We'll take a break here. We got John White coming. We've got. We'll do John White, Kelly Rubley, Jeremy Plonk. I think that's our ticket. All right. Although, Deja, I'll text you. I'll text you a decision on this front. All right. Back after this, halfway in, 90 minutes in, 90 to come. At the races, the snow now flying here in beautiful upstate New York. And these are tiny little snowflakes that don't bode well. This looks like one of those snows that might stay on. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Developed by Horsemen, horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, environment-friendly, paperless revolution of how equine industries bill and receive payments. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for each horse, whose owners can pay through the same website with just one click. Say goodbye to stacks of invoices, handwritten checks, and postage costs. Easy accounting for all parties with the highest online security measures. Get started free at horsebills.com. Simply register with your name and email address. Free to sign up. No subscription fees to vendors until the first invoice is sent. For owners, you get a free account, comprehensive dashboard with information on all horses owned and billing records, ACH and credit card payment options. For vendors, generate invoices efficiently and receive payments quickly from both owners and other vendors. Syndicate and partnership managers get flexible billing and payment options to both vendors and syndicate members. For more info, call 888-938-4643, 888-938-4643, or log on to horsebills.com. That's horsebills.com.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
DRF Sports Form Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Form delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsform. Enter code DRF Sports.
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio.
Surprise, surprise, so you rub your eyes. Never knew you'd be, yes, so cool as eyes. Hit a bite, then they'll be stupefied. Ducks categorize us as hard cries. That's a lie, we know why we're occupiers. The words would obscure style and these are high.
We're back at the races, past the bottom of the hour. Excuse me. And John White standing by after a good few days of racing at Santa Anita, highlighted undoubtedly by Hard Not to Like, who is in the midst of blossoming as a star, and Finnick the Fierce. I don't know if there's a mating to be had of one-eyed sires and a one-eyed mare, but this is another horse that is doing great things despite vision limitations, and horses count on their vision. That's a key component of their whole makeup. So what John Sheriffs has accomplished with her is quite impressive, and this seems like there's more upside. And then on Sunday came Charlatan, that just had everybody agog. 105 debut buyer, and he did it seemingly in a canter. And yesterday too, an Eddie surprise for Doug O'Neill and Mr. Redham, that kind of a horse I kind of a fan of his. He wins the Wishing Well to close out the weekend. John White presiding over a lot of it at Arcadia. John, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Yeah, we had a good week of racing, and that was just really a sensational debut victory by Charlatan for the Bob Baffert barn. It seemed like Bob Baffert was loaded with very good three-year-olds even before Charlatan, and this is just yet another one coming out of that powerful operation there. And as you pointed out, not only a huge 105 debut buyer, but just so visually impressive the way he did it. Kind of brought back memories for me of Precisionist, and back in the early 1980s, I can remember being at Hollywood Park, and when Precisionist made his career debut, Terry Lipham was aboard. Terry Lipham, a jockey who had the distinction of being a winner of the All-American Futurity, the biggest race in quarter horse racing at 440 yards, and the Santa Anita Handicap, one of the most prestigious races in the United States for thoroughbreds, aboard Bates Motel for John Gosden. So that was the versatility of Terry Lipham, and Precisionist just romped the victory. In fact, that was, if there was an example when people talk about a jockey's feet in the dashboard, which wasn't the case here with Charlatan, because Van Dyke wasn't like sitting with where they say the jockey's feet are in the dashboard. I mean, that's where a horse is really more than just geared down. I mean, and that Precisionist won so impressively that day. And I remember coming home to my wife, Tracy, and saying, you know, I think I just saw the best two-year-old in the country today. And she said, really? I said, yeah. I said, this Precisionist, he could be anything. And he won that race. It was a 6-furlong race by 7.5 lengths as an even money favorite. And, of course, Precisionist would go on to have a Hall of Fame career. And this Charlatan, just an eye-popping victory as well. Another one of the most memorable debut wins for me was Landalusi. Well, Lakeway as well.
Lakeway, too.
Yeah, Lakeway, too. Especially Lakeway was the one that where I was standing with Gary Jones when he was spitting nails and all upset one hot morning at Oak Tree. And he was trying to get a 6-furlong work from the gate out of Lakeway. And I mentioned that story to you a couple of weeks ago, right before Bob Baffert joined us. And it turned out to be Lakeway. Tucson was frozen over near the half-mile pole, just frozen. And they were supposed to work in company. It was a very hot morning, and Lakeway was a daughter of Seattle Sleuth. She had a tendency to get a little on the hot and washy side. And then when Lakeway outworked Tucson, who was an accomplished graded stakes-winning older mare, even though Tucson was a turf mare, but the fact that this two-year-old filly by Seattle Sleuth looked as good as she did in that workout. And the thing that I'll always appreciate about Gary Jones was, I said, at that time, I was doing the simulcast television work at Santa Anita, and I asked Gary, I said, would you mind coming on the air before her first race and talking about this first-time starter? And a lot of trainers would say, no, I don't want to jinx it or this type of thing. And Gary said, absolutely, no problem. And so he came on and said, this might be the best filly I've ever had. And I'll always appreciate that kind of candor and cooperation from Gary Jones with Lakeway. But Landalusi, of course, too, as I said, I mean, her debut win was absolutely spectacular, winning by 7 lengths and 108-1. And she came back 7 days later, which shows you what a different time that was in racing. There's a two-year-old filly. 7 days later, won that Hollywood Lassie Stakes by 21 lengths. Still one of the most spectacular performances I've ever seen, for sure. And the thing about Landalusi was, I covered her extensively throughout her life, including all the way up to her sad death as a two-year-old filly in the fall. And but I'll remember interviewing not only Lafitte Pinkeye Jr. after Landalusi's debut win, but also after the Hollywood Lassie Stakes. But I didn't just talk to Lafitte. I talked to Ray Sabil, who had ridden the runner-up Bold Outline, who finished a distant second, 21 lengths behind Landa Lucy in that Hollywood Lassie Stakes. And I said, what can you tell me about this race? And Racer Bill said, I thought I won it. I couldn't even see that other filly. And that was pretty funny. Ray had such a great sense of humor, and so I'll always remember that comment by Racer Bill, because it was the absolute truth to watch that Landa Lucy win by 21 lengths. And it's one thing for Secretariat when he won the Belmont Stakes by 31 lengths. That's a mile-and-a-half race. It's not easy to win a 6-furlong race by 21 lengths, so that kind of puts it in a little bit of perspective that in that short of a race to win by that huge of a margin. So a lot of good memories came kind of flooding back with that Charlatan victory, and wow, that was, like you said, Steve, I mean, it wasn't just the final time, which to see Aiden change the way this track has been playing these days, and then the Buyer 105 when Justify got a 104 in his career debut, which was certainly a sensational debut in its own right. Almost, you know, virtually at the same time on the calendar as Justify burst on the racing scene. But it was the way that Charlatan did it. And, you know, he did not seem to have the buzz. I didn't make him the favorite in the race, but I made it very, very close in that race between the two. But the Richard Mandela trainee had been so highly regarded into Nadal, and I really thought that that one would maybe go favored, Laneway, and Laneway did go favored. But, boy, Charlatan made it look like, I mean, he was 6-5 in a four-horse field, so it wasn't like he was any big price, but the fact that he ran such a sensational race and wasn't even the favorite certainly was talked about not only for the rest of that day, but since then as well.
And John, on that topic, I mentioned and came up yesterday with Johnny because I went and I pulled up Toby Terrell in DRF, and I pulled up the comments from Andy Harrington, and they were okay. I mean, they were seemingly positive about Charlatan, but clearly he was not doing the kinds of things in the morning that some of the Baffert runners, most notably Nadal, had been kind of heralded. And it's kind of interesting. However, elsewhere on the weekend, there was, I think, one or maybe two different occasions, because now people have latched on to the Miramati Maxim, which is the John White morning line favorite not going off as they near the gate as the favorite, and it's become a betting angle, and people are cashing in.
Well, one of those that happened occurred on Saturday, and it was rather surprising to me because I made Bowl of Spaghetti the 2-1 favorite and Get on Your Pulpit the 3-1 second choice. That was one of those to where I felt pretty comfortable that Bowl of Spaghetti was going to go favored, especially considering I did not make it 2-1 and 5-2. If I had made them 2-1 and 5-2, that would have been more indicative that I would have thought the favoritism could go either way. That's one of the things that horse players can look at for any morning line, is the fact not only what the prices are on the horses, but things like that, the gap between the favorite and the second favorite. That can give you a clue in terms of how the morning line person is thinking how strong of a favorite it is. It isn't just the price on Bowl of Spaghetti, but the fact that the second favorite wasn't 5-2, which would be the next notch, but two notches away at 3-1. And Bowl of Spaghetti was the betting favorite until quite late, and boy, the money came pouring in late on Get on Your Pulpit, who is trained by someone that I've known for like almost half a century now. That's Kathy Walsh, because when I first started working for the racing form in the 1970s at Long Acres, she was someone that I got to know pretty well and have known very well ever since then. And she's one of those that she's such an accomplished trainer. She was a training champion at Long Acres. Back when it wasn't, it was pretty tough for women. I mean, you didn't see very many women topping the training standings at any track in the United States. And in the 1970s, Kathy Walsh took over the stable when her father, James Walsh, passed away. And James Walsh was a very respected trainer on the West Coast, Northern California, and at Long Acres. And Kathy took over. One thing that helped Kathy a lot, she's told me, was that Joe Gottstein, who was the person that built Long Acres, opened it in 1933. And, in fact, my wife and I often go to plays at the Pantages Theater, and the architect of Long Acres was B. Marcus Pratica. He's the architect of the Pantages Theater and numerous theaters on the West Coast. And that was part of the charm of Long Acres, was it was such a beautiful racetrack, and part of that beauty stemmed from the fact that one of the renowned architects on the West Coast was the architect of Long Acres. And I always enjoy going to the Pantages, a theater in Hollywood here that had the same architect as my favorite racetrack when I was a kid. But Kathy Walsh, a very successful trainer through the years, and she's like Ron McAnally and some of these trainers that we've seen as they get up toward the end of their careers, and they don't seem to be able to get the clientele and the horse numbers. But it isn't like Kathy Walsh woke up today and forgot how to train. Believe me, she's as good a trainer as I've ever been around in my life. And that includes the greats, the Frankels, and you can go right down the line, even the Bafferts. I mean, and she's held in such high regard by her colleagues. But you got to have the horses, as any trainer will tell you. But this Get on Your Pulpit is co-owned by Marietta Gelich, who is the person that cuts my hair. So I'm always, following this Get on Your Pulpit, even when Santa Anita isn't racing. And so, in fact, my wife and I didn't go out for Valentine's Day dinner because it would be so packed, and I had to work on the Monday card boarding line for Santa Anita that evening. So we pushed off our Valentine's dinner till the next night. We went over to the Outback here in Arcadia, and who was sitting there having dinner but the co-owner of Get On Your Pulpit. We had a nice chat with her, and she headed over to Santa Anita after that, and they had a comedy show at Santa Anita after the races on Saturday that Jay Cullen, the renowned hornblower at Santa Anita, was the host of. And apparently that was a huge hit, and they're going to be doing that again. So that's something that Santa Anita is branching out into that was turned out to be quite popular, was a comedy show following the races at Santa Anita on Saturday. So Get On Your Pulpit, though, I was stunned. I wasn't surprised that he would get play. I made him the 3-1 second favorite. But the money, he just kept clicking down with each click late in the wagering there, and he ended up going off as the favorite. And Bowl of Spaghetti from the Peter Miller Barn, who I did make the morning line favorite, he ended up going off at 9-5, second favorite. And not only won, but he drilled that bunch. He won by, I think it was something around 7 lengths in that race. So it was really no contest to Get On Your Pulpit. Didn't run badly, finished third. And in fact, when I had that conversation with the co-owner, I already have a report on Get On Your Pulpit that they're planning to maybe come back in a shorter race next time, hoping to come back going 5.5 furlongs rather than 6.5 furlongs. So that's one thing about living close to Santa Anita. I mean, you never know. I could be sitting over here at the grocery store. I mean, just recently I was in line, and who was in front of me but Mike Pipey. I mean, the trainers and jockeys that we run into here, I remember one time picking up a birthday cake for my wife at the grocery store, and I come out into the parking lot, and who drives up to me and rolls down his window and says, "What are you doing with that cake?" And it was Corey Nakatani. And I said, "Well, it's my wife's birthday today, and I'm taking this cake home to her." And he says, "Well, just keep it away from me, because I can't afford to be eating any cake." And he rolled up his window and drove off.
I love it. I love it. John, let's talk a little bit about some of the other results, and notably Hard Not to Love. I've been trying to I've been chasing sheriffs for weeks to get him on. We got a lot to talk about with him. Honor AP is working back toward his seasonal debut. A lot of people excited about that. But this filly, hard-spun, Ontario bred, and just feels like with each passing start, she is just stamping herself as a major distaffer as the season unfolds.
Well, you're right. I'm a big Honor AP fan, so I hope you do get John Sheriff's on to talk about him because things seem to be going along very nicely there after a bit of a scare that caused him to miss the Sham Stakes. But it seems like things are clicking nicely over there with Honor AP, and he, at this point, the hope is he'll make his three-year-old debut in the San Felipe Stakes. Hard Not to Love is just yet another example of the, and this is something I don't say with an awful lot of trainers, but the horsemanship with John Sheriffs. I mean, he's not just a trainer. He's a true horseman in every sense of that word. And, I mean, he gets in these horses' heads. He's just through and through a throwback, actually, kind of to the old-time horseman. I mean, to me, a parallel might be somebody like a Silent Tom Smith who trained Seabiscuit, someone of that ilk that could take a Seabiscuit who had been really kind of a disaster on the East Coast. And look, Seabiscuit began his career trained by one of the all-time greats, Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons. I mean, it wasn't like he was in the hands of Joe Smith or somebody that nobody even knew about. One of the all-time greats had the horse, and the horse was running and claiming races and couldn't win. And Silent Tom Smith took over, and Seabiscuit became one of the all-time great racehorses in American history. And that's the type of thing that a John Sheriffs, I mean, he's obviously best known for his work with Zenyatta. We all know that. And that in itself is a tremendous achievement from the standpoint that I've said on your show numerous times. Zenyatta might well have not been Zenyatta if she'd been in the hands of a trainer who had pushed her more early in her life, because she was such a big filly that she needed time to not be pushed. And John Sheriffs gave her that time, and she debuted on Thanksgiving Day at Hollywood Park in her three-year-old year. And it was late as a three-year-old that she debuted, and look at what she accomplished in her life. But, you and I are big fans of Manistique, and you go back to her, and she was another huge filly. But John Sheriffs did a superlative job with her. And but this is a project for sure, because with the one eye and her idiosyncrasies of... And Mike Smith has been a big part of this success story as well. And it's the horsemanship of a Mike Smith, too. This is where a jockey like a Mike Smith brings so much experience to the table, but not only as just one of the great jockeys of all time, but as someone who came up, worked his way up from the ground up and was involved with taking care of horses, young in his life and around the care of horses, and is very versed in terms of how to deal with someone that has these quirks that Hard Not to Love has had. I mean, she ran such a big race in the La Brea, but she was flirting with being scratched before that race. I mean, she was pulling like a two-sod deal to where, she was just acting so goofy and freezing and that type of thing. And but John Sheriffs has figured out a lot of the things that will work with Hard Not to Love. I mentioned Ron McAnally, and this is an example of Ron McAnally with John Henry. John Henry started his racing career in Louisiana. He was a decent horse. He went to New York. He was okay. And then Lefty Nickerson got him, but it was when Ron McAnally got that horse here in Southern California. And John Henry was such a cantankerous horse. He's one horse that I didn't ever get close to when I was at that McAnally barn, because John Henry might very well take a big chunk out of your arm. And but Louis Senecola would be on John Henry, And they would start off to go to the track to exercise in the morning, and Ron McAnally's barn is right there at Baldwin Avenue, so he's the farthest away from the track that you can be. And Louis Senicola, they would take two or three steps, and John Henry would stop. Now, in most cases, the rider would push the horse or, you know, urge the horse or try to get the horse going. You know, McAnally at that time had a big stable, and they had a lot of work to do and a lot of horses to take care of. But they knew with John Henry, the key with him was let him do what he wants to do. Don't push him. And it would take 15 minutes to a half hour for that one horse to get from that McAnally barn all the way to the track. And once they finally got to the track, John Henry would want to stand in the mile and a quarter and look around for a good 5, 10, 15 minutes, and they'd let him do it. And once they reached that point, John Henry would go out and train and do whatever Ron McAnally wanted. And that was a big part. And that's just a glimpse of the things that go into trying to work with these horses and find out. It's like a good coach in basketball that you want to, you need to push this player, but you can't push this player because then he won't produce. And it's what makes the great coaches, a John Wooden or the greats that we've seen, Mike Krzyzewski. And this is what makes John Sheriff such a great, like I say, not just trainer, but horseman, because he's been able to work around these issues with Hard Not to Love. And look what we're seeing now, these performances. I mean, that's another visually impressive performance. She got another triple-digit buyer. It was down a tad from her impressive La Brea, but 100 nevertheless. But, I mean, she won with such authority that, and she's really starting to develop a following, which is great in our game. When the horses connect with the public, which obviously Zenyatta is about as great an example of that as you'll ever see, but California Chrome was another one. We had the Chromies. Anytime, you know, my all-time favorite horse, Turbulator, had such a following in the Northwest. Anybody that went to the races in the Pacific Northwest in the 1970s, they not only know of Turbulator, but by and large, they're all big Turbulator fans. He was such a charismatic and popular horse. And this Hard Not to Love is starting to develop quite a following in her own right.
Part of what's gone on with this filly, for those that didn't see the two different, there were two different interviews that Brittany Ayrton conducted on TVG. The one she did with Martin Lopez that I retweeted on, I guess it was on Sunday night. I'll draw attention to it again. But Sheriff said, referenced Lopez as well in the interview, that the post race interview that he did with Brittany and or with Christina Blacker, I'm not sure, but the confidence building that's associated with a horse like this, that is not, I referenced how difficult it is for horses who count on their field of vision, and you know, as flight animals, they you know, they have a sense of what's around them, and not being able to see, a certain portion of the horizon, I suppose, is a real challenge for a horse. And John talked about Lopez putting his hands on her and the, you know, the tactile communication that has overcome her fears associated with her limited vision. And as you referenced the patience, I frequently tell the story of Carla and Marty Wolfson and what they did with Mies Approval, who was sour and didn't want to train. And Carla would sit on him for an hour and let him go wherever he wanted to go at Calder. If he didn't want to go through the gap and train, he didn't have to. He could walk around. He could just do whatever he wanted, and eventually he started to train again. And that's what this takes. And you have to recognize talent, and then you have to have a cooperative owner, and communicate to the owner, you know, let us take some time, and etc. And yeah, that's what you can reap when you have, you know, that kind of a system, and you've got the communication not just with the horse but with your personnel too. So if you haven't seen the Martin Lopez interview and the sheriff's interview, seek them out on the TVG timeline. They're both really edifying and also very heartening about how much concern and care and dedication and love goes into, you know, the training of horses.
Well, I'm glad you bring up the groom too, because they don't get the credit that they often get, you know, deserve. For instance, I was just talking about John Henry, and Jose Mercado was a huge part. He was the groom for John Henry, for Ron McAnally, and that was yet another huge component to the success of that two-time Horse of the Year, John Henry, winning the first million-dollar thoroughbred race in history, the Arlington Million of 1981, but also a Horse of the Year at the age of nine, something I've said many times I don't think we'll likely see again in our lifetime. I mean, we'll see. A lot of times when I said that, I said, we'll probably very well could see another Triple Crown winner, and we've seen two in recent times now with American Pharoah Justify. But I've said, to show you the difficulty of being the Horse of the Year as a nine-year-old, I mean, it's one thing just to be a Grade One winner as a nine-year-old. That's a feat tremendous in itself. But to be a Horse of the Year, to put a resume together to be Horse of the Year at that age is phenomenal. And but Jose Mercado was a big part of that. And you talked about the patience. And again, I remember walking one day. This is one thing that I just liked so much about being around people like Charlie Whittingham as many mornings as I was. And I remember walking from the racetrack back to the Whittingham barn at Hollywood. And we were walking between by the racing office, actually. And Hollywood Park had a swimming pool there at that time. And there was another trainer that was trying to get this horse over to the swimming pool. And the tactics being employed by that trainer were very, like a person in the school that's being a severe disciplinarian. I mean, they were really trying to use every way they could in a not mean, but it wasn't love and tender care either. And Whittingham, he stopped walking, and so I stopped, and he just looked over at this scene that was unfolding by the swimming pool, and he looked at me, and he made a comment about, you know, that's not really the way to do that, and then started walking again. And that's one of those things that just you never forget, because I remember thinking, that's interesting that one of the great trainers of all time is not giving his stamp of approval here to how that particular horse is being handled that morning. So, and needless to say, that trainer that had the horse that was he was trying to get into the swimming pool can't even come close to what Charlie Whittingham accomplished as a trainer. And there's another guy that I would use the phrase horseman. Richard Mandela would be another one that I would use that term, horseman. I save that for the people that that I feel have that really merited to be called that. And John Sheriff's is certainly one of them.
Oh, no doubt. John, let's get a couple of thoughts in while we got the chance. I'm sure you'll write up your weekend thoughts now that we're beyond the holiday Monday and the Southwest. The three-year-old races, some thoughts about the two Risen Stars and yesterday's Southwest?
Well, the Southwest, the thing that I thought was very impressive was the guest on your show yesterday, Nick Tamaro. I mean, he didn't just say that he liked Silver Prospector. I mean, believe me, I perked up like a horse that's about at feed time when he said, I've been waiting a long time for this race and for this horse and so forth. That got my attention, because someone that puts as much time and effort into this game and is as good a handicapper as Nick is, and when he talked up that horse, and look, this horse went off at 9-2 and won like, you know, he should have been 9-5. So that's just very impressive with me. Those are the type of things I mark down with the people on your show. It's like with Mark Cassie. You know, Mark has had such a good credibility through the years. When he gives you a horse and says, hey, watch out for Wonder Gadot or, you know, this or that. And it, Mark's not right 100% of the time. But none of us are in this game. Nobody's perfect in horse racing. You know, that's one thing I like that Andy Serling says. We're going to be wrong more often than they're right, and it's true. And, you know, Andy is very spot on when he says that. But, boy, Mark Cassie's not wrong very often when he brings up horses on your show. And Nick could not have handicapped that race any better than he did. And, he also kind of dissected the morning line quite well, too, because I was paying attention to his comments about that and then was taking a look at that to see how the betting would unfold vis-a-vis the morning line. And Nick was spot on in all of his thoughts along those lines, too, in terms of horses that he thought were lower than they should have been or higher than they should have been. So he had that race completely dissected, and that's what is one of the things that's great about our game, is that when you get that strong of an opinion, you can go back it up at the mutual windows, and if you're right, you're going to be rewarded, and certainly I know that Nick had to be rewarded nicely off of that, and Silver Prospector off that win, to me, he's certainly, you know, back in the game. In terms of heading down the road, and he's got a Hall of Fame trainer in Steve Aspison, who said after the race that it'll be on, you know, to the Rebel, and then after that, the Arkansas Derby, and he's going to be one of the major players in those two races for sure.
How about Saturday in New Orleans? Thoughts about the two Risen Stars?
Well, Mr. Monomoy, I thought, ran very well. He ran the better, I thought, of the two, as reflected by the buyers. He got a much better buyer in the race. His race the time before was one of those that was better than it really kind of appeared, because he was, of the speed horses, he was the only one that kind of hung around. You know, it shows you how this game, we're constantly learning. We never stop learning, because, it, you know, that's a relatively kind of new observation that people have made that I've picked up on, that for much of my life I'd never really paid that much attention to, and that is, but I've seen it like in Kentucky Derbies. For instance, Congaree would be a great example of that, that in the Point Given Derby, so much attention was focused on Point Given coming out of the Santa Anita Derby, and I felt he would be a Triple Crown winner, and he was darn close. He won two of the three, but he just picked the wrong day to run a subpar race in the Kentucky Derby that was won by Monarcos, and a very fast Kentucky Derby at that. But Congaree, in one of the fastest paces in Kentucky Derby history, for him to hold around, to hang around and finish third in that race was spectacular, really. And he would go on to have the kind of career befitting a performance like that. He was even able to win a Hollywood Gold Cup at a Mount a Quarter, and that was a great training accomplishment by Bob Baffert to get him to win at that distance, because Congaree going a Mount a Quarter was really pushing the envelope, sort of like when Laz Barrera won the Belmont Stakes with Bull Forbes. I mean, that was one of the greatest training accomplishments and riding accomplishments by Angel Cordero I've ever seen. To get that horse to win at a mile and a half was unbelievable. And I thought Mr. Monomoy really ran quite well in defeat in the LeCompte, and he showed that that thinking was pretty good in terms of the fact that this time the pace was more to his liking, and he ran a good race. And one thing about it, he's on an upward trajectory. He's improving. You know, he's being the half-brother to Monomoy Girl. He's had big shoes to fill, so to speak. And a lot of times we see these hyped, you know, half or full siblings not pan out. But this one, you know, after a bit of a – he's been kind of a project for Brad Cox, and he's been, you know, one to kind of push that horse, and he's let him kind of develop. And that's a word that, again, that the real horsemen, you can use a lot. They'll develop a horse. That's what a McAnally would do, or a Mandela. And even we've seen that with Bob Baffert in recent years. Look at how he brought Arrogate along and West Coast along. I mean, those are horses that he did not push to the Triple Crown, and he reaped the benefits because they became three-year-old male champions. So Mr. Monomoy, I thought, was very good. And look, Modernist has one of the greatest trainers we've ever had in this game, too, and Bill Mott. And even though that race, to me, wasn't on a par with Mr. Monomoy's, nevertheless, we're just scratching the surface with that horse, and there's a tremendous upside there as well. So there's no telling where the ceiling will be with Modernist. I think there's a lot to like with him, too. So things have really gotten quite interesting on the Kentucky Derby trail, or the road to the Kentucky Derby, as I guess we should say, since that's the official name, and we have the points associated with that now. And I thought one of the biggest developments on the Kentucky Derby trail here in the past week was the fact that Maxfield got back on the work tab, and that Brendan Walsh was asked point blank by Caton Bradar on TVG, is it too late for the Kentucky Derby? Because she said, I thought her interview was outstanding with him. She asked the right questions, the questions I want answers to, and she said, the clock is ticking. Is it too late for the Kentucky Derby? And he said, I would not count anything out at this point. And Brendan Walsh is the type of trainer to me that when he says that, I certainly think Maxfield is still in the game here to maybe make the Kentucky Derby. And I think that is a very, very talented three-year-old. That race he ran at Keeneland, and that was flattered by Governor Morris coming back to win his career debut and almost tying the track record. In fact, in the days that I called charts, it would have tied the track record because we did it in fifths, not in hundreds. So horses like him would have been credited with tying the track record, and instead, because we're in hundreds, he was 2/100ths off the track record. But a very big comeback win there for Governor Morris to beat Untitled, who ran a very good race, I thought, for the Mark Cassie barn. And but I think that this really, you know, Maxfield could be a very, whether or not he makes the Derby, I still think he could very well be one of the leaders, if not maybe the leader of this group. And I'm saying that even when we're looking at that powerful brigade over there at the Baffert barn. But that Maxfield to me, and it's what Brendan Walsh talked about him, you know, up to and after that Breeders' Futurity at Keeneland. And like I say, that was flattered because he absolutely buried that field that day. And horses that he creamed have come back to run well. And that is real indicative that we could be dealing with a very special colt in Maxfield. So that was big because the clock being ticking, we couldn't get much further down the road here, and he would be definitely out of the Kentucky Derby picture. So the fact that Brendan Walsh says he's still in the picture and that he is back on the work tab is pretty exciting to me.
Well, going to be a quiet weekend coming up, but lots clearly to continue to digest. John, thanks. We'll talk next week.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
John White, everybody. Let's take a break here. Kelly Rubley going to join us. And Jeremy Plunk before noon. So 45 plus to close out a busy Tuesday. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest, we know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet, and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $125 are on them. Sign up at ExpressBet.com using promo code BYK. That's B-Y-K. And you'll get $125 when you wager $500 within your first 30 days. See what I mean? House money just for playing the races you were going to bet anyway. Check out ExpressBet.com for more information. And don't forget to sign up using promo code BYK. B-Y-K to get that $125 bonus. You're going to love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee.
Conditions apply. Must be 18 or older and 21 in certain states. Open account with ExpressBet LLC and reside in a state where such activity is legal, void, or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
The North American foal crop continues to decline, but not here in Pennsylvania. In 2019, our number of mares bred increased for the third year in a row, this time by 12.5%. Why? Our stallion roster continues to grow. We have the best incentives and bonuses. Plus, there's the stability of our Racehorse Development Fund. Why breed anywhere else? This is Brian Sanfratello. Go to PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
I could be wrong. I could be right.
We're back at the races. About 15 into hour three. Been a fast-moving Tuesday. And for those of you that were concentrated, I don't know, Fairgrounds or Gulfstream or whatever you were watching, if you didn't take part in the Laurel action on Saturday, you missed the Campbell. And it may have been the best race of the weekend. And it involved a current Kelly Rubley trainee and a former Kelly Rubley trainee, Monongahela, and Always Mining, toe-to-toe, like Jaipur and Redan. It was out of this world, and Always Mining starts the edge away and take control late under Julian Pimentel.